foot is greener than my tweedie when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading more reminiscences of life in Durham in the early 1900s by Betsy Holloway from her book, Heaven for Beginners. Resuming in Chapter 2, The Walls Were Strong. The breakfast room opened onto a hall that contained a wall niche built especially to house our telephone, a functional black four-party line model that my mother and father answered with a pleasant, inquiring, "All right?" The hall was too narrow to place a chair next to the phone, but that didn't matter because no one was expected to use the instrument long enough to sit down anyway. This unspoken rule was first breached when, at the age of 3, I learned to dial my Uncle Sam's number. Charmed by my new skill, I thereafter called him every morning before he left for work. Unfailingly kind and patient with children, Uncle Sam was always surprised and delighted to hear my voice. For my part, I felt pleased and happy at being able to enrich his life with my calls. I never noticed that after I had unnecessarily identified myself, and we'd both assured ourselves of each other's good health, conversations tended to trail off into brief observations punctuated by long, companionable silences. Fortunately, Uncle Sam never noticed either. Down the hall from the telephone was the linen closet, with its shelves of white sheets and blue towels, its hamper of clothes awaiting Monday, when they could be washed, and the rag barrel, where I could rummage methodically and happily through a rainbow of clothes history. Worn-out linens, threadbare and outgrown garments all found their way, sooner or later, to the barrel, together with fabric remnants from the dresses, blouses, and skirts my mother had sewn for herself, as well as for me and my dolls. Here were scraps of green and blue gabardine from my school jumpers, remnants of crisp yellow organdy from my first long dress, carefully stitched for me to wear for my Fluttering Butterflies piano recital duet with Eleanor Cowan, pale blue net and matching poplin, left over from the ballet costume I'd worn to turn cartwheels with Grace Hess into a school performance in Watts Street School's gym, my worn-out pink-flowered cotton flannel pajamas, maroon poplin and green plaid chambray remnants from school dresses, scraps of a yellow-flowered blue cotton flower sack that had been transformed into a sunsuit, a length of clinging, discreetly patterned blue rayon from a Sunday dress of my mother's, green Dan River cotton from my favorite sundress, underpants to match so that I could boldly turn handsprings on the school playground without first checking to make sure no boys were sneaking looks. A few scraps of white batiste from my baby doll's long dress were there as well, and sometimes I could find treasures, snippets of lace, a few inches of narrow satin ribbon, a scrap of velvet, to hoard in my miniature cedar chest, or else to create elaborate birthday or Valentine's cards for my mother. And when I could get past the fascination of the rag barrel to climb the wall stairway at the back of the closet, the attic offered boxes of old dresses, shoes, and hats that were splendid for dressing up. After I'd rummaged through and properly attired myself, I came back downstairs, set my small table with my pastel tea set, and entertained my dolls with milk, cookies, and my best company manners. The basement was my father's domain. There he kept his shotguns, boots, and hunting clothes, neatly organized and always put away clean in their own wooden cabinet. There, too, he kept his yard clothes, and each afternoon, on arriving home from work, he descended the stairs with his slow, careful tread, to change from his uniform before going out to mow the lawn, weed the flower beds, or work in his vegetable garden. At dusk he came back into the basement, this time to shower and put on clean clothes for dinner, which at our house was supper. With its shower, toilet, and large laundry sinks, a tin dipper hung on the wall for anyone who wanted a drink, the basement served to lighten the demands on our one tiny bathroom, As well as using the facility himself, my father occasionally allowed favored male roomers to shower downstairs instead of taking tub baths in the bathroom. Female roomers were never accorded this privilege. Also in the basement was our wringer washer, where my mother spent most of each Monday washing clothes before carrying them in baskets to the backyard, where they were stretched taut with wooden pins on the clothesline to dry in the sun. On rainy Mondays, clothes dried on a line in the basement. Irrespective of weather, the wash on Monday schedule remained firm. Normally, I preferred to stay out of the basement, because parts of it, particularly the staircase, were dark and frightening. But as long as my mother was working there, it was safe for me to descend the stairs and join her. Once securely there, I could remain even after her departure, and spend hours poring over old ladies' home journals, Women's Home Companions, and McCall's, reading their stories about career girls who discovered that all they really wanted was to get married and keep house, about young wives who were being driven to distraction by their children, but only briefly until they met a smartly dressed career woman who confessed that she'd give anything to be in their place, with a husband, a house, and babies, about marriages that were strengthened when husbands' old girlfriends, usually career women, moved back to town. Best of all were the stories of enchantment, the ones about plump, gray-haired little fairy godmothers who transformed everyday objects into fresh, charming prom dresses, and about young boys who impetuously changed stern teachers into rabbits, and then suffered agonies of responsibility and guilt. Sorcery had its uses, it seemed, but it was advisable to keep the upper hand. From the stories, I turned to articles, features, and columns. I always checked to see whether Eleanor Roosevelt was talking about teenage pregnancy or anything else of interest in If You Ask Me, whose crisp, starched tone implied delicately, but unmistakably, that despite her goodwill in offering solutions to readers' personal problems, the former First Lady's primary interests lay in weightier concerns, such as the UN. I studied the Ponds ads, with their Astor, Vanderbilt, and Gould beauties, who were invariably gifted harpists or violinists, accomplished linguists, sparkling hostesses, former officers in the waves, or daughters of, quote, one of our greatest families. If the magazines weren't too old, I looked for coupons that I could mail off for Truchet lotion samples, or sterling silver Neptune's Daughter pins, or a trial bottle of Dreen shampoo. I skipped the dull articles, the ones about Your Colicky Baby, and Meriden, Connecticut's Answer on Housing, in favor of the Sub-Deb column, and features about Ingrid Bergman, and once in a while I came across something that seemed vital enough to cut out and save for future reference. Into this latter category fell such revelations as an article about college men's preferences in women, which disclosed that men preferred girls with shoulder-length hair, 34, 24, 34 and a half measurements, and faces radiating sweetness and warmth. My hair, though technically shoulder length, was on the dull and stringy side, and 34-inch bust and hip measurements seemed a star beyond my grasp. But I did practice radiating sweetness and warmth in the direction of my dresser mirror for the next 2 weeks. Better Homes and Gardens and The American Home were less fun than McCall's and The Companion, being short on college men and fairy godmothers, and long on slipcovers, home heating systems, and lawn chairs. Still, I could usually manage to find a few pictures of glamorous rooms for my dream house scrapbook, and most of the home magazines offered the stunning full-page color Armstrong's ads, with their breathless accounts of young wives who, though struggling bravely on a pittance after their husband's return from the war, contrived cannily, with the aid of Armstrong's linoleum, to acquire the kitchen or powder room of their dreams. When I finally tired of reading magazines, I could rummage through our old trunk and gaze at grandmother's long gray wool wedding dress, white kid gloves, and initialed silk handkerchief. And once, for a few weeks, my mother kept 100 fluffy pale yellow baby chicks in a pen close to the furnace, where they could stay safely warm. Whenever I went down to see them, they peeped contentedly, pecked daintily at their feed, and took one drop of water at a time in their beaks, turning up their heads to let the liquid run down their throats. For them, I braved the dark stairs several times a day. Our yard was a rainbow of flowers, most of them fragrant, pink peonies that my grandmother and her sister had dug up and moved from the yard of the old house, white lilies of the valley, red and yellow roses, pink sweetheart roses, white bridal wreath, blue and pink hyacinths, bright yellow forsythia, lavender lilacs, golden daffodils, purple and white iris, white gardenias, coral japonica, purple violets, and the tiny brown sweet shrubs that we liked to pick and let wilt until they smelled like ripe strawberries. Two huge crepe myrtles, one pink and one fuchsia, bloomed splendidly each June next to the street in front of our house. Purple wisteria vines wound in and out of our back fence. Ivy flourished along the brick that banked the lower flight of steps to our front door. Together with our profusion of flowers and shrubs, my father grew apple, peach, and fig trees, as well as pecans, scuppernongs, and Concord grapes. We even had an apricot tree that he had nursed carefully into bearing maturity, despite the fact that apricots were seldom hardy enough to survive North Carolina's winters. And every year, on the vacant lot behind our house, he planted a large garden that yielded baskets full of juicy red tomatoes, butter beans, okra, yellow squash, pole beans, potatoes, cantaloupes, cabbage, and white corn. My mother canned and preserved, and later froze, so many vegetables and fruits that she scarcely ever had to depend on Piggly Wiggly for produce. And between spring and fall, the times were few when she was unable to pick flowers or fruit from our yard to take to a neighbor, or to use for ourselves. Though I was an only child, playmates were plentiful. Back of our house on Second Street lived Jack Lester, whose front yard held a large, spacious umbrella tree, easy to climb and possessed of a fork of branches that formed a seat perfect for the two of us to sit in and eat chocolate marshmallow cookies, read comic books, and drink lemonade. In the block north of ours on Buchanan were the Morgan boys, the younger of whom occasionally entertained us girls by casually turning his back to direct an impressively high liquid arc into the shrubbery. Across from the Morgans lived tall, slender Caroline Garrett, who reveled with me in the delicious excitement of a two-member secret society, whose sole activity consisted of sending coded messages in tiny glass bottles, carefully deposited several times a day under the big mimosa tree on the corner. Down the street in the other direction, I could play with Jean Poe, Ruth Jernigan, and sometimes Dickie Carter, who actually lived an hour away in Henderson, but came over often to visit his grandmother, always bringing with him a satisfyingly large stack of comic books to trade. Next door to Dickie's grandmother, in a rambling white frame house with a wraparound porch, lived blonde, handsome Billy Warren. We rarely met because he was several years my senior, but whenever we did, he smiled and greeted me kindly, and I secretly idolized him long before he high-stepped and twirled his way into fame as a drum major, first for Durham High's marching band, afterwards as the state champion. Across the street and beyond the Jernigan's house stood a white duplex, where Linda Hawley lived in one side and Janice Sue Rogers in the other. Everyone liked them, though Janice Sue had an annoying habit of running home in tears to her mother whenever anyone hurt her feelings, which was about twice an hour. Between their duplex and the ones in which lived Angeline Norris and the Donahue girls was an empty lot with a swing set that had end bars for climbing and playing skin the cat, and after I was old enough to leave my yard, it was there we most often gathered during the daytime. We were nearly always in motion, playing hopscotch on the sidewalk, turning cartwheels and handsprings, taking our turns jumping rope and turning for someone else, nonchalantly riding our bicycles without touching the handlebars, and racing, turning, coasting on our roller skates. Skating required some forethought, because you had to leave off your everyday kids and wear substantial shoes with soles, preferably saddled Oxfords, that could hold the metal toe clamps. And then you had to keep your skate key available to tighten or loosen the clamps every time you wanted to put on or take off your skates. Since hardly anyone's skate key ever fit anyone else's skates, losing your key was one of the most annoying things that could happen, and most of us wore ours on firmly knotted strings around our necks. Usually we just skated back and forth on our block, trying hard to dazzle each other by going directly from racing speed into a 180-degree turn. But when I became brave enough, I coasted all the way down the steep, block-long hill north of our house, offhandedly luxuriating in the awed stares of those less brave. Even in the daytime, when all our fathers were away at work, the neighborhood was a busy place. Most of our mothers came outside whenever produce salesmen drove down the street with their truckloads of watermelons and peaches, butter beans and squash, and door-to-door salesmen frequently stopped by to offer encyclopedias, vacuum cleaners, and Bibles. The Fuller Brush Man made his rounds every few weeks, and no matter how busy she was, my mother always took the time to sit politely and study his catalog, after which she bought a dollar vegetable brush or whisk broom, so the salesman wouldn't have wasted his time. The postman delivered mail twice each day. Three times, Sundays included, during the Christmas holidays, when cards arrived from everyone we knew. The afternoon mail, though, contained mostly circulars, while morning brought the mail of note, letters and greeting cards that the senders had considered important enough to seal and put a 3-cent stamp on, rather than leave unsealed for only a penny. Twice a week, the Durham dairyman came by early in the morning to pick up empty bottles and leave fresh milk in the metal box on our front stoop. And nearly every summer afternoon, a tinkly music box tune announced the arrival of the ice cream man. And then we all had to race for home to ask our mothers for nickels to buy fudge sickles or banana popsicles or Dixie cups of chocolate ice cream. When I was small, our backyard held a sandbox for me to play in with my tin bucket and shovel. After I was 5 or 6 years old, the sandbox disappeared, but the yard still yielded wonders. The apple and peach trees burst into pink and white clouds each spring, and the pecan tree had one low limb that was perfect for Skin the Cat. Buddy and Spunky, my terriers, lived in the backyard, spending cold nights sheltered by the small house that concealed the chute to our cellar coal bin, and usually we owned 2 or 3 much-petted yellow or calico cats, more often than not accompanied by multi-hued kittens of uncertain lineage. The yard included an abundant crop of clover, and the hours I spent looking it over rewarded me not only with 4-leaf specimens, but 5- and 6-leaf ones as well, all of which I diligently pressed between the pages of my Bible. My wooden swing hung from solid round posts that my father had erected just in front of the peach trees, and whenever I wanted a bird's-eye view of the immediate environs, I could climb the ladder that went up to the flat black tin roof on our garage. Usually I came back down nearly as black as the roof, but fortunately the color washed off. In the flat, grassy, dandelion-dotted expanse of our front lawn, my friends and I spent endless summer days flinging each other into statues, tantalizing with Simon Says and taking gallops, grasshopper leaps, and giant steps. When showers came, we donned bathing suits and played in the rain. When the weather was hot and dry, we hopped and skipped under the hose. We jumped down the front brick steps, leapt across the walkway, and minced elegantly along the brick wall at the foot of the yard. Occasionally we tried, with singularly slight success, to walk on Caroline's stilts, which my mother persisted in calling Tom Walkers. When we needed a few minutes' rest, we picked dandelion puffballs and blew away the seeds, or made clover chains, or stripped the middle petal off violets to reveal the tiny man seated inside, or lay flat on our backs, thus acquiring a persistent and maddening grass itch, and scrutinized the sky for cloud pictures. Usually I saw kittens, angels, fairies, and dwarves. Dickie saw dogs, horses, and trucks. Caroline saw flowers and trees. Jean Poe once insisted she saw Jesus talking with the elders in the temple, but no one believed her. If I wanted to go outside my own yard for entertainment, I could walk a few steps down the back alley to where Mr. Barnes, our next-door neighbor, kept his goats. Usually he had 2 or 3 grown females, all bearing biblical names, Mary, Martha, Rachel, as well as a Billy. All of them coexisted happily, and the females begat baby goats with pleasing regularity. They were clean and healthy animals, the privileged possessors of a large fenced enclosure to ramble in during the day, and a cozy white frame house to sleep in at night. Mr. Barnes even donned a spotless white cotton jumpsuit with matching beret to feed and care for them, and if anyone living nearby were ever ungracious enough to complain about his unorthodox 4-footed neighbors, I never knew it. In addition to my good fortune in having goats for playmates, Sometimes we drank fresh goat's milk, a rich and naturally homogenized liquid so bluish-white that Durham dairy milk looked yellow by comparison. Mr. Brown's proudly supplied several satisfied customers with milk, and always he delighted in showing his animals to anyone who came and visited. Only rarely did the goats give him difficulties. Once in a while he had to sit up all night with an ailing mother or baby, and one spring he was vexed by rodents that plundered the large bags of feed in his garage. Fortunately, though, our enterprising tortoise-shell cat quickly smelled out this promising new hunting ground, and once or twice a week thereafter we were summoned loudly and insistently to our back doorstep, where, when we arrived, Skitscat joyfully exhibited a large dead rat. With this problem solved, Mr. Barnes' unusual hobby presented no further annoyances, and years later, when he and his wife had decided to build a new house outside town, his first concern was to design for the chosen site a suitable pen for the goats. Our house stood on the southwest corner of an intersection. Since the other three lots on that corner were vacant, except for trees and wildflowers, I had plenty of safe wilderness to explore. To the north lay two open fields that teemed with dandelions, bluebottles, goldenrod, and Queen Anne's lace. Hundreds of tiny yellow and white butterflies swarmed there, darting and swooping joyously rather than drifting and hovering with the dignified grace of the large swallowtails in our yard. Few trees grew on those lots, except for one huge pecan tree and the lovely mimosa that not only served as Caroline's and my secret message depository, but also blossomed splendidly into fluffy red powder puffs each June. Directly facing our house, though, was a heavily wooded area that sloped sharply down to a tree-shaded creek. In the middle of that lot stood a thicket of plum trees with several low branches that made perfect horses for riding or seats for daydreaming. Usually we played in the wooded part for a while, and then made our way to the bottom of the hill to pick pussy willows beside the creek. A culvert 5 feet or so tall carried water under the neighboring street, and if the creek were low, we waded through the metal passage to the other side. Once we'd arrived and played around the tall, graceful weeping willow for a while, though, there was nothing much else to do except wade back through the drain to where we'd started. Our mother's annoyance on discovering that we'd been playing in the culvert merely lent an additional fillip to the expedition, though it did us no good when we returned home with painful stone bruises from walking barefoot on the pebbles in the creek. Since I wasn't allowed to leave our yard after dinner, during the long summer evenings all the other children on the block came to our house to play. After darkening the front of our house so as not to attract mosquitoes, my parents went out on the porch to rock contentedly, talk over the day's events, entertain neighbors who walked over, and watch us play Ain't No Booger Bears Out Tonight, which frightened me nearly to death. The adults kept an eye out for falling stars, while we caught lightning bugs to go into a mason jar with holes punched in the lid, where the insects lit up methodically for the rest of the evening. When everyone had to go home, we opened the jars and shooed the bugs out, thus assuring our supply for the next night. We had June bugs, too, which didn't sting but buzzed aggressively, and resembled bumblebees too much for most of us to feel really comfortable with them. But one evening, when I lay dejected and ill with an earache, too sick to go out and play, Sterling Brockwell kindly caught a June bug, tied him onto the end of a long string, and brought him into my bedroom to cheer me. Since Sterling's interests were already running toward airplanes and football, we had little to talk about, and I was all the more overwhelmed by his solicitude in coming to visit. Together we watched the bug fly about, buzzing in noisy protest, for half an hour. When darkness approached, Sterling carefully pulled up the string until the shiny insect rested gently on one palm. Then, sheltering it with his other hand, he went outside to release it into the warm, starlit night. Though we could play outdoors nearly all year long, weather was frequently capricious, occasionally sharp. Forecasting was often inexact, so that summer brought violent and wholly unexpected thunderstorms that sent my mother and me scurrying around the house to close windows. Winter offered rare snowstorms that were more often accurately predicted by the appearance of tiny snowbirds than by the weathermen. One Sunday morning in January, while my parents still slept, I walked sleepily to our front door to pick up the Herald, but when I pushed the screen door, it refused to open. Puzzled, I looked up and outside to discover that the yards, trees, and streets, as far as I could see, had been magically blanketed with white. The door was banked tightly shut by a 6-inch snowfall that had come, quietly and without any warning at all, during the night. Even 2 inches of snow, let alone 6, constituted a major event in Durham. Because snow was a rarity rather than a way of life, the city owned no equipment with which to clear it away. Any snow at all, therefore, usually resulted in the schools closing for several days, delighting us children and irking our mothers. If, as usually happened, the temperature rose for a few hours and then dropped again so that the snow on the streets melted somewhat and then refroze, anyone unlucky enough to be driving fought a perpetual, though variable, battle against slush, ice, and slush again. None of this troubled my friends and me, of course. We viewed snow as one of nature's blessings, a miracle to be enjoyed to the fullest. As soon as I'd gulped down my Rice Krispies and Ovaltine, swallowed my cod liver oil, and struggled into my snowsuit and galoshes, I was outside for the day, except for when hunger struck, or when I had to go to the bathroom. In our front yard, Caroline and I lay on our backs in the snow and waved our arms up and down to make snow angels. Jumping up, we threw snowballs at trees and at each other until we were tired. Then, buckling down to serious work, we built a snowman, giving him small pieces of coal for eyes, a carrot for a nose, a dried red pepper for his mouth. We begged a scarf, hat, and broom from my mother for the finishing touches, stood back and admired our creation, and then headed for the steep hill just north of my house to go sledding. Neither of us owned a sled, but heavy pieces of cardboard served quite well to slide down on. If one of the Hearst boys brought their sled and joined us, so much the better. When 5 o'clock and dusk arrived, we returned home cold, wet, exhausted, and happy beyond belief. After stripping off my soggy snowsuit, my mother deposited me into a hot tub filled with bubble bath, where I soaked for half an hour before languorously getting out to put on my pink flannel pajamas that had been warmed on the radiator. And after dinner, when my mother had mixed together milk, sugar, and vanilla, and my father had brought in a large platterful of fresh, clean snow to add to it, we ate snow cream that was scarcely more substantial than a moonbeam, but fluffy and delicious while it lasted. Enveloped in a cloud of warm, tired contentment, I felt my eyelids growing heavy and began to think about going to bed. Tomorrow, my father promised, the snow would still be there. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.